Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with
Catherine Kane. I'm the director of the National Geographic Museum.
And I love coming here. We came for an awesome Indiana Jones exhibit, and actually there was a different Titanic exhibit a couple years ago, and now this is called Titanic, The Untold Story. And there's some cool Cold War ties here that a lot of our listeners didn't know. So if you came to the last Titanic here, this one's totally new. Explain how this one differs from the last one a couple years ago.
Well, what most people probably don't realize is that when Bob Ballard discovered the Titanic in 1985, he was actually on a classified mission for the U.S. Navy to document two sunken 60s-era submarines at the height of the Cold War.
And who did these submarines belong to?
These were U.S. submarines that were lost in 1963 and 1968, the USS Scorpion and the USS Thresher. The biggest losses to the U.S. Navy since World War II. Both had nuclear reactors. USS Scorpion had nuclear weapons on board. And Bob Ballard, who was a very famous underwater explorer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute at the time, had all the technology needed to document these ships. There was really only one thing that he wanted to do, which was to use the Navy's resources to go and look for the Titanic.
And so it just, explain to our listeners how it just so happened that the Titanic was situated between these two sunken subs, or serendipitous, and B, how Ballard struck a bit of a deal with the U.S. government military in order to, let's say we're going to go look for these subs, but while we're at it, if we have time and money left, let's look for that Titanic.
Oh, that's true, that the Titanic just coincidentally, the wreck site for the Titanic just happened to lie right between these two subs. The Thresher was off the coast of Nova Scotia, and the Scorpion was sort of near the Azores, south of the Azores, and Titanic was right in the middle. And Bob, who was really one of the most innovative scientists at the time with some new technologies and imaging technologies in particular, was really confident that he could both accomplish the Navy's mission and have a little bit of time and resources left over to go after the Titanic. In the end, he had 12 days after his mission, his classified mission was complete. He had 12 days. And
so they found the Scorpion.
They had
12 days left.
They were documenting the Scorpion and the Thresher. These were both classified missions. There were naval intelligence officers on board his ship. And they also had National Geographic on the ship, you know, and National Geographic had no idea at the time, and this was back in the mid-80s, that there was all this classified stuff going on under the water. But Bob had a great poker face, and he was very diligent, and they did their work for the Navy, and then they went off to find the Titanic, and I think they had 4 days left when they were able to discover by the tracing of the debris field right up to the Titanic wreck site, and it was a really big deal.
And you mentioned when we were walking through the exhibit about how the fact that they were looking for the submarine tracing the debris field, how that actually, it was almost good that they went through that as like a trial run so that when they got to those 12 days, they knew to look for the debris field of the Titanic.
Yeah, Ballard learned a lot by documenting the Scorpion. And what he probably learned the most was that you're not looking for the ship itself. You're looking for, in many instances, a mile or more than a mile's worth of a debris trail. So some of the observations that he made in documenting the Scorpion wreck were really useful to him when he was looking for the Titanic.
And we all were laughing when we were walking through because you said that the Navy was almost a little annoyed that they found it because now we got to run a newspaper article about them finding the Titanic when really we were hoping that, maybe part of them maybe hoped that he didn't find it so that the covert mission could stay covert. But
yeah, I don't think the Navy secretary was overjoyed when he got the call from Bob saying, hey, guess what? I found the Titanic. They really didn't want the cover story to be blown. But it was such a big deal that we couldn't report it. There was a press conference here at National Geographic back in the summer of 1985 when it was announced, and Bob made a subsequent trip out into the field in 1986 with Alvin, the famous submarine from Woods Hole, and documented some of those quintessential pictures that you'll see from National Geographic on the first pictures that were seen of the Titanic.
And let's go into the exhibit itself. You guys have some really cool. First, talk about the submersibles, the actual vehicles that they took down there, and then we can go into some of the items too. But talk about you have the Alvin down there, at least the pressure chamber.
Well, the exhibition's kind of divided into three parts, right? We talk about the cover story. We talk about this classified mission, which was only declassified a few years ago. The Scorpion, the Thresher, the backstory, the untold story, if you will, of what Bob was doing in the North Atlantic in 1985. The second part of the exhibit is really about the technologies, which were pretty early robotics, if you think about it. The first examples of equipment and technologies that were being used to sort of take people out of the equation and send robots down to the deepest depths of the ocean to do what humans could not do. I think the Navy was very interested in that technology. Certainly science is very interested in that technology, being able to see things that we can't see with our own eyes through imaging technologies and deep water submersibles. And then the third part of the exhibit is really about the ship itself. We profile some of the survivors of the ship, some of the personalities. We have artifacts that were either taken off the ship by survivors or things that have passed down through generations of families. And of course, the whole thing is a partnership with the National Archives. So we've got wonderful documentation from their rich collections from passengers on the ship.
And speaking of which, I was, no joke, getting goosebumps standing just a couple inches away from some of these, from, let's say, the deck chairs on the Titanic. We've all heard rearranging the deck chairs. We all know about, I can't use it if I'm saying it. So why don't you list some of the awesome artifacts, be it the furniture, you know, some things that might go with the musicians that were playing, and then some of the passenger artifacts.
Yes, well, we do. We have two deck chairs in the show. One is a deck chair from the Titanic, one of only seven that survives. And then we have a deck chair from the Carpathia, which, of course, is that lesser-known ship that came to the rescue and rescued all of the survivors, over 750 survivors of the Titanic. And that was a smaller ship. It was not as grand as the Titanic, but nevertheless, they were the real heroes of the story. They had to sail at top speed through the same ice field that claimed the Titanic to get there in time to rescue the survivors of the tragedy. So we've got the two deck chairs. We have some incredible props from the 1997 blockbuster movie Titanic, which we borrowed from the 20th Century Fox archives. So you'll feel like you're surrounded by familiar surroundings. And
what are some of those props?
Well, James Cameron did a wonderful job of trying to recreate the sets of that movie in as accurate of a way as possible. He was kind of really obsessed with that. So we've got the first class suite, Rose's suite.
Where the drawing happened.
That's
the couch,
right.
Is there.
The famous drawing, the couch is there. We have the Marconi room, so the famous radio room from the movie where the SOS signals were going out from. We've got wonderful costumes. We've got that great third class bunk set where Leonardo DiCaprio spent the night, the one night that he spent on the ship. And so there's just a lot of fun props from the movies in there. But we've also got some really interesting real artifacts that belong to real survivors of the ship.
Let's go into some of those. Tell me about Astor and Molly Brown and the musicians as well. Give me some sound bites on those.
Yeah, so Wallace Hartley was head of the eight-person orchestra. You may remember from the movie that there was the orchestra that was playing until the very end, and that is actually a true story. Wallace Hartley was the head of this orchestra. He did not survive the sinking, but the music pouch that he carried around all of his sheet music in was recovered from his body. And so that's included in the show, along with the sheet music that was inside. He's another one of the heroes, another one of those untold stories that you will learn about in this exhibit. J.J. Astor was the wealthiest man on the ship. He and his 18-year-old wife, Madeline, who was 5 months pregnant, were on their way back from an extended European vacation. And so we have her life jacket and his pocket watch. He did not survive the sinking. She did. And so we have those two artifacts, his pocket watch and that life jacket that she wore during those harrowing hours after the tragedy.
Back together for the first time, right?
We're exhibiting them together for the first time, yeah.
Reunited. And that life jacket is just cork. It's so different from today's life jacket.
No, you wouldn't recognize it today. I wouldn't recommend that life jacket today, but it did its job at the time.
And what do we have from the unsinkable Molly Brown?
Margaret Brown, she never called herself unsinkable. The press gave her that name, but she was a loud voice of reason during the chaos of that night. She was actually the one that tried to convince the lifeboat captain to turn around and go back. They had excess capacity on their boats, and they were able to, in the end, only rescue one additional person. But still, one life is a big deal. She was carrying in her pocket a little Egyptian statue. It's called a Shabti. She had actually been in Egypt buying art and antiquities for the Denver Art Museum when she was on this trip, her trip home on the Titanic. She ended up giving that little statue to the captain of the Carpathia as a thank you for rescuing all of them. So that's in the show. And a lot of other artifacts that have interesting stories to associate with them.
Tell me a little more about the movie costumes, the Captain, Jack, and Rose. Explain those.
Yeah,
so have them all together in one little set.
Yeah, we've got some costumes. Costumes are always fun to see. And we've included Captain Smith's costume. We've included one of Rose's ball gowns that she wore on this incredible ship. And then we have the one costume that you see Jack Dawson in throughout the entire film. And that is a part of the set that I was describing of his third class quarters, which were a little less fancy than you might think, but still probably a lot better than a lot of other ships of the time.
Absolutely. Just sort of wrapping it up, big picture stuff. Whether it's the James Cameron movie or all these actual artifacts and people just continually, every year, obsessed with this thing. Why do you think we are still, I mean, we talked a little bit about when we were walking through, but why do you think it captures the imagination of the public a century plus later?
Well, it's the story and the lessons of the Titanic seem to be stories that we constantly want to hear, right? I mean, here is the probably, at the time, the greatest example of technological achievement. This was the biggest ship, the best ship, the most luxurious ship. And yet, when up against Mother Nature, it still wasn't enough.
So it's man versus nature. You described it as almost like an Icarus.
It's like the Icarus story. It's man versus nature, but they're also, I don't think that you can forget that there are also these incredible stories of heroism and survival, right? So there were people that survived. There were laws that were changed. There were lessons that were learned from this tragedy and there was great discovery, right? If you think about the century since the sinking and all the science that's taken place, all the expeditions, all the times we've retold this story again and again. So it's the classic story of tragedy and survival.
And class divides.
And class divides and man versus nature. It's all of those things rolled up into what we are now remembering as the greatest shipwreck of all time.
And for that reason, why should our listeners come out? They've seen the movie. Maybe they came to the exhibit a couple years ago. Explain why this one in particular is a must-see while it's here in town.
Well, I think you know the story, but if you come to this exhibition, you'll learn that there are still new chapters of this story that are continuing to unfold. We are the only East Coast venue for this exhibition, and it's a wonderful opportunity to probably learn some stories that you didn't know before.
And I just got to say, after having walked through it, it is one of the coolest. Like, it exceeded all my expectations, too. I was getting goosebumps time and again. You learn from a historical perspective. You learn about the subs and the Cold War and the expedition. And I had no idea that's how they ended up finding the Titanic. So it's cool on a historical level and insightful. And then from a movie buff's perspective, you get to see all the costumes and everything. And then on just a human emotional, you can't help but be moved and get goosebumps at all of those artifacts. I mean, you have the life vests and the pocket watches and the sheet music and the deck chairs. I mean, I'm starting to get chills just thinking about it. So thank you so much for putting it together for us.
Thanks for coming.